variable. So what we've been doing up to now mainly is just looking at something like functions of R, or if you were doing cosmology, your space-time would be a function of T. But obviously, that's quite restrictive, having something that depends on only one direction in space-time, and it would be nice to be able to explore more general solutions. So one way we can do that while still maintaining a level of analytic control is to look at things that depend on two coordinates in the metric. So roughly speaking, it means that in four dimensions, you now have only two killing vectors. So today, I want to explore a particular metric that depends on only two of the coordinates. And rather than tell you what it is up front, what we'll do is we'll try and explore this metric and then sort of try and get some physical interpretation of it. And then I'll talk a little bit about what we'll call axisymmetric solutions in general. Okay, so I've just written down something there that depends on two coordinates, x and y, and I have to tell you what these functions are. So basically, you should spot that f of y is basically minus g of minus y. So they're the same polynomials, but I've just chosen to sort of try and distinguish, distinguish each of them so it's obvious in whether I'm talking about a function of x or a function of y. So unless you've seen this before, this is sort of going to look a little bit like a rather obscure type of metric. So if we just sort of stop and think about it for a minute, we've got an overall factor, this 1 over a squared here, x plus y squared. So that's an overall multiplicative factor for the metric, that we call that a conformal factor. But then inside, we've got this pattern of two of our boxes, our little building block type of things, where this piece only depends on y, and this piece only depends on x. So we can sort of see that there is, again, this building block structure, but the conformal prefactor mixes the two boxes together. So the first thing we should do is decide where this metric has the right signature. So we need to think a little bit about the ranges of our coordinates. So we want to have the correct signature. And so that tells us that we want F positive and G positive. So if we look, let's look at g, for example. So if we look at the function g and just do a bit of sketching, try and figure out what's going on. So if I look at it at x equals 0, g's 1. At very large x, you can see that g's obviously negative, so we know that it does something like that. And then for very large negative x, you can see that it's positive, but we've also got this minus x squared piece. So depending on how big 2gma is, we could have something that looks like that, or we could have something that looks like this. So we've got a bit of a choice. Now, I've suggestively written that final coordinate here as a phi. So I'm thinking that this is an angular coordinate. So here we've got killing vectors d by dt and d by d phi. And I'm going to say that phi is an angular coordinate, which means it's periodic. So if I wanted to have something that looked maybe like a distorted two-sphere, where I have a two-sphere, but maybe I've sort of given some theta dependence to it, then this would tell me that I would want to have two roots for G, because they would correspond to two poles on the sphere. Also, if we think about it, remember F is just minus G of minus Y, which means that we flip. We're essentially doing a sort of flip on the y-axis and a flip on the x-axis of this potential. So any zero also corresponds to a zero of f, which means we have horizons in our space-time. So let's have just a little look at if we say we want two roots for g. Well, obviously, if 2gma was 0, g would just be 1 minus x squared. So we'd have two roots at plus and minus 1. And then switching on our 2gma term, that sort of shifts those roots to the left. So if 2gma is 0, you can see that putting x equals cos theta means that that last box is just the metric on the 2-sphere. So this is motivating this as a sort of deformed 2-sphere. So let me call these three roots x1, x2, and x3. So I'm going to order them. So that tells me where or what range my x-coordinate is on. Now, the other problems I've got are when x plus y is 0, because then that conformal prefactor blows up. And then I have to think about the range of the y-coordinate. So taking, again, thinking about f of y, it means that y has to be in the range of minus x2 minus x1, or it's going to have to be less than minus x3. So that's just, so far, all I've done is I've identified what the coordinate ranges are and sort of argued that the adding in a non-zero GMA is looking like what we have here is some sort of space-time that's not quite spherically symmetric, but it has some sort of, it's like a distorted two-sphere. So it's still got axisymmetry, it's still symmetric around the axis of the sphere, but somehow we've sort of stretched it out. So let's try and see if we can get this to look a bit more familiar. So we're just going to do a coordinate transformation on the y-coordinate. And if we set y as 1 over Ra, then if we look at what this f of y is, then what I find is my function, f of y, starts to have something that looks somewhat more familiar. So obviously when I wrote 2 GMA, I was already being extremely suggestive of what the constant was in front of that cubic term. And what you're seeing here is that by changing coordinates, I've got something that looks like a Schwarzschild potential, the 2 GM on R, and something that looks like a de Sitter term, a cosmological constant. So if I put those pieces together, my metric starts to have a much more familiar form. So if we just forget about the x direction for the moment, so we know that there is this prefactor there, but let's just think a little bit. We were trying to identify what was going on with the space-time at potential problem points, which was where there were singularities in the metric. And having done this coordinate transformation, we now feel we've got a little bit more confidence about interpreting the metric and the singularities. So in this format, it really looks like we have two horizons, or potentially two horizons, one of which looks something like a black hole horizon, and the other of which looks something like a de Sitter or acceleration horizon. So we've got something that's where R is roughly 2gm. So it's essentially 2gm into 1 plus order gma squared. So if you're thinking about gma as being a small perturbation, and that looks like an event horizon. And then the other horizon, which is R, is roughly 1 on A, again, plus sort of order GMA squared. Maybe just GMA, actually. And that's like the de Sitter horizon that we had. But of course, there's no cosmological constant. That metric over there solves the vacuum Einstein equations. And so this is really an acceleration horizon. So what do we mean by an acceleration horizon? Well, if we have a uniformly accelerating observer, there is a limit to the amount of space that they can see. So the reason is, obviously, a uniformly accelerating observer will asymptote the speed of light, both sort of if they're uniformly accelerating with respect to us. Let's say we're at rest as far as we're concerned. We are an inertial observer. A uniformly accelerating observer will, in the infinite past, have been traveling very nearly at the speed of light or as arbitrarily close to the speed of light. They come in, they're always accelerating away from us. At some point, they're instantaneously stationary, and then they go shooting off in the other direction again, asymptoting the speed of light. So for this observer, they can't see, well, they can see this region of space-time, but they can't see anything that happens over here. So this is an inertial observer, say us, and this is our accelerating observer, and this transformation of flat space-time, which we've already seen when we looked at the domain wall, is called a Rindler space-time. So this was discovered by Rindler. So we've seen this when we looked at the domain wall. The domain wall was on a hyperboloid, so it was a bubble on a hyperboloid in Minkowski space-time, and that was a uniformly accelerating bubble. So so the domain wall metric looked like it had horizons in it, but in the end, that was simply because it was the wall that was moving, if you like, relative to the space-time. And it's the same here. The XY system of this, this particular metric is somehow an accelerating coordinate system. Now, that's identified what's going on as far as the TY part of the metric is concerned, but we still need to think a little bit about what's happening in the X phi part of this solution, because we know that phi is an angle. We suspect that X is some sort of distortion of the theta coordinate, but how is it distorting the two-sphere, and can we be sure that it's distorting it without a singularity? So we have to look a bit closer there. So we could write our theta coordinate is the integral of dx on root g, so that this part of the metric was just d theta squared. So if we did that, it gives the theta coordinate in terms of elliptic functions of x, but then that means, of course, that g of x is some rather ugly expression of theta, which is, at least to leading order, we know that it's sine squared theta, but the impact of the GMA term kind of distorts that interpretation. So it doesn't really give us any enlightenment doing that particular transformation. So what we're going to instead do is focus on what we hope that are coordinate singularities, but we need to know whether or not they are. So we're going to focus on the polar singularities. So what would be the north pole and the south pole if GMA was zero? So in other words, x is x2 and x is x3. So if I look near one of those singularities, so this is rather like what I did when I looked at the Euclidean black hole, I'm going to focus right in, right near one of these poles. And so I'm going to look at what my metric looks like there. And I'm simply going to expand right near that pole. So near the pole, I can obviously, I've got a very similar type of expansion as I did with the Euclidean black hole. I know that I'm going to have a square root of x minus xi. So that's to give me a sort of dx squared over x minus xi. And then if I divide by G primed, I suppose I define this as my local theta coordinate. So let's just see what that gives me. D theta is going to be dx over square root of g primed of x, x minus xi, which is exactly what I want to locally have the metric look like d theta squared, or that part of it. So notice that what I put under the square root is always positive. Over here, xi is x2, so x is bigger than x2, so x minus xi is positive, g prime's positive. Out here, xi is x3, so x minus xi is negative, but g prime is also negative. So what's under the square root is always positive. So this has made the theta part of my pole look good. So that's a little tick in brackets. We're happy with that. So now let's look at the phi angle part of this. So if I look at the d phi squared piece, then g primed of xi times x minus xi is equal to theta I squared over 4 times g primed of xi squared. So theta I squared is to leading order sine squared theta I. Times this factor, g primed on 2. So notice that if we set 2gma equal to 0, g primed would be, or the modulus of g primed, would indeed be 2 at plus or minus 1. So this all tallies with phi having a periodicity 2 pi and having non-singular north and south poles in the absence of any sort of additional mass terms or acceleration terms. So what can we do otherwise if GMA is not zero? Well, what we need to have for the pole to be non-singular, what we need, since I've written my sine squared theta I here, is that we need the periodicity of the angular coordinate times this factor of g primed on 2 to be 2 pi. But now I'm in a little bit of a quandary, because if I look at what g primed actually is at those roots, and my my drawing's really bad here. It's not the same at these two roots. So if GMA is zero, you've got something which is nice and symmetric around around the y-axis. Adding in the GMA has sort of distorted your curve. It's made it into a cubic. It's kind of shifted it to the right. So g primed of x3 has become a bit steeper, and g primed of x2 has become a bit shallower. So the two gradients are not the same. The periodicity, because what we want is for this to be non-singular. So how do you decide whether when you've got metric functions that go to zero, whether it gives you a singularity or not? What you have to do is you have to make a change of coordinates such that the metric is non-singular in the new coordinates. So what you're saying here is that, I mean, I think we kind of almost forget about the normal polar coordinate singularity. We sort of ignore that all the time. But of course, the normal, say, spherical polar coordinates are indeed singular right along the axis, so along the north pole axis and south pole axis. And the reason we never worry about that is because we know how we got the spherical polar coordinates. We got them from the x, y, z in the first place, you know, writing x is r cos theta, etc. So we actually put the singularities in there almost in the first place, going from a completely regular coordinate system on R cubed to one which had these polar singularities. So that's a situation where we went from a sort of global coordinate system to one which had some coordinate singularities. When you sort of get a solution of Einstein's equations, and then you want to look at what the geometry means, you don't necessarily know a priori whether, when some of these metric functions blow up, whether that's a real singularity or not. So when Schwarzschild wrote down his metric, there was a debate for some years about whether R equal 2 GM was a real singularity or not. And of course, the absolute definitive evidence that it isn't is once you write down Kruskal coordinates, because then that's your maximal analytic extension of the space-time. You see that the horizon is nothing special, and in fact, you know how to go beyond the event horizon in that case. And so here, this is doing essentially an analogous thing. What we want to do is near these x2 and x3 singularities where g goes to zero, we want to set up a local regular coordinate system. So in essence, what we're doing here is we're saying that, you know, this is some local singularity here. And what we want to do is we want to set up some sort of x, x and y, so Cartesian x and y coordinates. So I'll call them x1 and x2 coordinates, which are just locally the origin on R squared. So I'm not taking that final step. What I'm doing is I'm making it look like the origin in plane polar coordinates. So if this thing looks like the origin in plane polar coordinates, I'm home. I don't need to do that last step of going to x1 and x2 because I'm very familiar with the polar coordinate system. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I want something to look like locally, like, so here it would be d theta I squared plus theta I squared d phi squared, where this has a range of 0 to 2 pi. So I can then write x1 here is something like rho cos phi, and x2 is rho sine phi. So I want to have a completely non-singular point here at either of those zeros of g. But the problem is, if I choose, say, a g2, suppose so if I choose this phi angle here to be equal to g primed of x2 over 2 times phi, so that this has periodicity 2 pi, then my periodicity at x3 will not be equal to g primed of x3 on 2. So in other words, I don't have, this means we're non-singular at x2, but then at x3, I'm going to have, again, d theta I squared plus theta I squared . This is what my metric looks like locally. So it's not, that factor is not one. But we've seen this already. We saw this when we talked about the cosmic string. If you either have a periodicity of an angle that isn't 2 pi, or if you have an angle that does have periodicity 2 pi, but it's not multiplied by r squared, but by some constant not equal to 1 times r squared, then what you have is a conical singularity. So we've seen this, and we know how to interpret it. We know, therefore, that our space-time contains a cosmic string. So if, remember I derived this where I said the constant was lambda. If lambda was bigger than one, then it was a conical excess. If lambda was less than one, then it was a conical deficit. So what this is telling me is that since g primed of x3 over g primed of x2 is bigger than one, if I fix my periodicity to make x2 non-singular, I have a conical excess at x3. If I fix my periodicity so that x3 is non-singular, then I have a conical deficit at x2. I hope that that's sort of obvious. It's basically saying that if you fix it at x3, you've got a conical deficit at x2, and vice versa. So if I try and sketch what that means, what it means is that I've made something non-singular at one pole, and I'm obviously exaggerating this. I'll make a conical deficit because I want a positive energy object. So I have something that looks a little bit like this, extremely distorted, of course. So here, this would be x3, this would be x2. So thinking about, therefore, what I've pieced together, I've found that by making a coordinate transformation, I've got a space-time that looks rather like a black hole space-time. It's a conformal factor times something that starts off looking like Schwarzschild to Sitter. And in the angular directions, it's like a sphere, but it's distorted, because at one pole it's regular, but at the other pole you've got this conical singularity, which you can interpret as a cosmic string. And thinking again, the GM, the M looks like a mass of a black hole, so I've got one event horizon. Looking at the A term, the A is pre-multiplying that minus A squared R squared, so it's looking like another horizon, which is rather like a Rindler horizon. So it means I've got something that's accelerating, something with an event horizon, and something with a cosmic string. So what's actually happening is that the string is pulling the black hole and making it accelerate. So it has a name. It's called the C metric. And it's a nice example of a non-trivial metric involving black holes. So if I now draw a maximal sort of extension, I've got something that looks like this. Try and make it. So this is just meant to illustrate. Here you've got the cosmic string world sheet. This is the black hole. So you see here the structure that's like the Rindler space-time. The black hole's following something that looks like a hyperboloid. If you analytically continue across the acceleration horizon, you find a sort of copy of your space-time, just like the Schwarzschild case. And so what you've really got are two black holes, which are kind of being pulled apart by cosmic strings. And except that each of them never quite sees the other because of, you know, always accelerating apart. But if we were sitting here as some observer in the middle, we would see both of those black holes accelerating apart.
In terms of actual observations.
So the point about this particular, if we sort of now go away from exact solutions and think about when could this metric crop up in reality? Okay. So what the only time that we could envisage this metric cropping up is if we have cosmic strings. Okay, so that tells us we need a field theory with cosmic strings. Now the standard model doesn't really have cosmic strings in it. So we've got to imagine that we're at some sort of grand unified theory which has these defects as sort of part of its spectrum. So these cosmic strings are going to be extremely heavy as far as we're concerned, because they're going to have sort of grand unified type tensions. Now, you can, if you think about what this is saying, if this is saying that up here we've got something that looks like that, from our perspective in the middle, okay? So how could we imagine this being set up as initial data, okay? Well, there are two possibilities. So one is that you actually form one of these things during some phase transition in the early universe, which means that you need to have something which produces a string and then something that's going to produce a point-like object, which then collapses. So we need something that produces a monopole here. So that's not impossible. It depends on the topology of the actual sort of grand unified theory, topology of the vacuum in that. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that you start off with a string and then it breaks. Like that. And it can do that even if the topology is not doesn't necessarily allow you a monopole. Okay? So the reason is that in this situation, this would be via some sort of tunneling process. And in fact, this C metric gives you, again, if I let's do it in a different color, if I analytically continue to the sort of Euclidean space, then I find that in fact I can analytically continue my C metric, and it gives me a tunneling process for splitting strings. And in this case, topology of space-time changes, which is what allows me to have the strings ending on a black hole. So that's another setup in which it could happen. But if you calculate the probability of that process, it's kind of rather small. So it's not that it couldn't happen, but this one is an extremely small probability. So that one would be a much more likely setup. And so then you could compute, you can compute sort of gravitational wave signals coming from cosmic strings. And so you can also compute if you have these monopoles sitting on the strings, that also gives slightly different signals. So perhaps one could see them this way, but we need to see a gravitational wave first. People have actually calculated that. So just as a brief mention, other multi-black hole solutions. Here we've got two. So we can construct charged black holes. So this is where you now consider Einstein-Maxwell theory. And in this case, you're allowing the charge to be essentially balancing the mass. Oh, yeah, sorry. Thank you. Thanks. And so it's possible to build multi-black hole solutions because essentially you have charge repulsion equals gravitational attraction. And I can't remember if David wanted you to do that in a tutorial, so I might just not say. Not today. Oh, so I'll leave that hanging in the air there for a moment. And I just want to sort of wrap up by just showing you a bit more general axisymmetry. I just really want to make a couple of general comments. If you want to look at axisymmetry in general, then you have to sort of make a general ansatz to the metric. So if, again, you want to have a sort of parity invariance of the metric, you end up with this type of block diagonal form. You've got d by dt as your killing vector, d by d phi as a killing vector. And then what's left is the sort of other two space-time directions, which you could, well, you can label them whatever you want. In this case, I've labeled them R and Z. And because a two-dimensional metric is always conformally flat, I can choose to write that as with the R and Z part of the metric with a common prefactor. And so the reason for writing this particular choice of functions is so that when you look at the Ricci tensor, you end up with the equations kind of peeling off into a particularly nice form. So in this case, if you were in vacuum, if you're looking for a vacuum solution, then this alpha function simply satisfies a Laplace equation. And so you can choose a gauge in which alpha is just R. So that simplifies your vacuum axisymmetric Einstein equations. And in fact, it makes them kind of iteratively soluble, because if you choose alpha equal to R, then what you have for the lambda equation it would be zero, or possibly a delta function source. Then this is just the cylindrical Laplace equation. And so you can find your solution for lambda. So if you're in vacuum, or indeed TRR plus TZZ is zero, and so that then is, you've got a you can actually superpose your solutions. You now have a sort of linear equation for lambda, and so you find that you can solve the Einstein equation somewhat more easily. So in these coordinates, for example, a single black hole, so the Schwarzschild black hole, so what this is a Newtonian potential for a rod. So the Schwarzschild black hole in these coordinates looks like a rod along the z-axis of length 2m. And so you can build up multi-black hole solutions. You simply obtain this final metric function through integrating up out what your known lambda is. So this is telling us that multi-black hole solutions are superpositions of these rods. So you could have another rod here, for example. But when you integrate up and find the new function, you see that there are conical singularities. So although this is a static metric, if you want to have two black holes, you can only do it if you have a conical singularity. So the interpretation of this is that you have two black holes held suspended along cosmic strings. So the tension of the string is counterbalancing the gravitational attraction. It's an unstable equilibrium. So you can see that although, in truth, real black holes, astrophysical black holes, are essentially isolated Kerr black holes. They're all Kerr black holes. You can nonetheless, in theory, when you're building up solutions, you can actually build up all sorts of quite interesting and exotic black hole space times. So I want to move on next time to looking, I want to go beyond Einstein gravity or start to think about going beyond Einstein gravity, looking at different sorts of gravitational phenomenology. So the first step we have to take is just thinking about the Einstein action and how we can perhaps change that, and then we'll move on to extra dimensions. So basically the theme of this week is sort of moving towards higher dimensional gravity.